Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the premiere episode of Everybody Talks, a talk show that's going to just get people around the Vancouver area, if not around the world, talking about their profession and the things that they do for a living. Today, my name is Buzz. I'm going to be a host regular on this show, also followed by Mike.
How's it going, everybody?
Now, today we have a special guest with us. Matt, introduce yourself.
Hey, how's it going, everybody? My name is Matt Matthias Timo for my listeners and readers out there for my books. Otherwise, you can just call me Matt. That's perfectly cool. I am a writer. I do write different books. I'm working on a couple right now, and I'm glad to be on here today talking about the profession and what I do for myself as well.
And obviously, we really appreciate, obviously we know each other, but we really appreciate you being on the show. Now, the whole purpose of the show, ladies and gentlemen, for everybody who's going to be new listening to this or sharing it on Facebook or any other social media that might be out there, the purpose of the show is to get people that we know around the city or friends that we know to be able to promote themselves on a whole different level. Now, they talk about the profession on the show, like we have you here today, right, Matt?
All right.
And they're going to talk about the things that they've learned throughout their life, and we might get a little bit off topic, but then again, we will steer ourselves back on. That's what Mike's here for, to make sure that we're on point. You didn't know that, but you know it now.
Well, that's probably a good thing, because I really get off topic a lot.
You know what? That's fine. That's the point of the show. So you know what? Now that we've done that, and everybody's now listening, grab whatever you need. If you got to pause, grab your beer or whatever it is that it is. We're about to start. Let's kick things off. Matt, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do and how it started?
I was going to say, well, if you want to talk about writing, I guess. I was going to say, I don't know if that's 100% what I do, but sure. as far as the books, yeah, I've been doing this forever, pretty much since, I'd say, a teenager, just kind of writing different things. I've got different genres and that I go with. First book I put out was actually a collection of poetry. Now I'm just mostly working on fiction. I do a lot of short fiction stuff as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, and you know, one of the things I want to touch on is actually when I first actually met you, we were working at a certain big box retailer.
Mm-hmm. Bad times.
Bad times, of course, yes. And of course, everybody who's going to be on the show, we're all connected in some sort of way. And that's the beauty about it, right? Is that you have friends that are be able to, you know, kind of put it out there in a different level. Now, your books, you've written one so far.
Mm-hmm. One novel, yeah.
One novel, Between the Devil and Charlie Parker.
Yeah.
Wonderful read for anybody out there who would, and I'll say it now, for anybody that wants to pick up that book, you can go to pretty much any major website whenever it comes to it, order it on Amazon. You can go on Chapters, Barnes & Nobles, and I believe it's going to be coming to your own personal website soon?
Well, I do have it on that. Typically, the links are going to be through Amazon on that as well if you wanted to do it. It's pretty much available around the world. I have checked it out, which is kind of cool. So UK, India, Australia. Crazy pricing, but yeah, it's all good.
You want to tell our audience a little bit about that book?
Sure. Book itself. It's a bit of a concept book. So I don't know if everybody's going to get it. It is kind of set up mostly as a jazz riff or as a jazz album. So if you look at it, it's got 11 chapters. There's an intro and an outro, and then 9 basic chapters in between, which are set up to 9 specific Charlie Parker songs that the main character or narrator of the book likens to different kind of aspects of his life as he goes through that.
And I mean, myself has personally read the book, and I know, Mike, I know you're a fan of the book because you caught me, you know, and I'm now on the third time reading it because the first time, you know, obviously I didn't read the instructions at the beginning. Even though I'm reading a book, I know that kind of contradicts it. Two, the second time, I decided to put on a pair of headphones and put on jazz on the Galaxy Radio, which is now Stingray. I'll probably bleep that out later. Nonetheless, the third time is... that's what we do. The third time is being told that there is an actual soundtrack to the book. If you want to elaborate on that a little bit.
Sure. So, I mean, if you look at each of the... in the chapter headings or in the... you know, the chapter section of the book at the beginning. It shows you each of the chapter titles, and then there's a song kind of in brackets with the actual length of the song that goes through with that. So it's kind of set to each chapter. He has that song that's specific to him. So the character has a certain playlist that he plays through every night, and he goes through, and that's what he listens to because he wants to reminisce about different aspects of his life, different time periods, and each song is tied to each of those periods, so that's what he does.
And that's one of the things that I found very unique about this book is the fact that you the sound. I want to call it a soundtrack, being a big movie guy. And you know, for somebody like myself who always has to have some sort of audio or some sort of background noise going on, the fact that I can read this and follow along with certain songs for each chapter really was the selling point for myself. Mike, I don't know about yourself.
For me, I listened to the first time I read it, I listened to the music. Because I was well aware of it, unlike others. But no, it definitely, like, your experience was probably going to be a lot different than mine. The fact that you read it without it, than with jazz in general, and then with the specific playlist in mind. I did it with the specific playlist in mind, and it gives you that, as if you are sitting in the bar. On the other side of the bar from these characters having their living the book, and you are sitting there watching them have this conversation or this experience or whatever, and it puts you more in tune with the story itself. And I wish there were more books that were written with a soundtrack in mind, with something like that in mind, a theme that you could press play at the beginning and go all the way through. An awesome mix. As a Guardians of the Galaxy reference, there.
Yes, and a good one at that, right? And that's what, again, one of the things that really stuck out about the book is that the fact that you can do that, and a lot of audience out there might not be into that sort of thing. But reading it for the three times, well, going on the third, but the first time, you're right, I did see it differently. It was a different mindset. It was a completely different picture. The second time, the fact that I'd put on jazz in the background on my headphones and I was listening, it really brought me to an atmosphere of you know, where I would be as a character on that stool at the end. And for those who will pick it up again on Amazon Chapters or Barnes & Noble's online, we'll get to the point where they read that and they understand what we're talking about. But with the music alone, it's and the fact that now I'm going to be going in with the actual soundtrack to it would totally change the game and how we first, you know, read that book.
Well, and it's funny, when I wrote it to the idea behind it, it's kind of a cyclical story anyways, that you can see it. So one of the characters in there is the bartender, John the bartender, and how it, I don't want to give too much away, but the way that it works is with the main character, you can see him becoming more like where the John the bartender character is, so you can see him kind of transplanting throughout, and the story, it's perpetual the way that it moves. One guy goes through, takes over, and then the next person takes over that role. And it's just kind of set up, with the music especially, it's set up for the motif that I wanted to really look at was each of us has a specific type of music that we have that we go to in our lives that really fuels or protects us or does anything like that. And that's kind of where I wanted to go with that for the soundtrack. Because we all kind of have a soundtrack to our lives that we depend upon or we look to for our strengths as well. So yeah, all aspects of life have the same music to them. We're drawn to specific rhythms, and each of us has our own music. With that, that's kind of where I was going for me. And the reason why it's jazz music and Charlie Parker specifically is that's kind of the music that drives me a bit. And just knowing a lot about Charlie Parker and what he did, he was always searching for that perfect melody or that note between notes, and he listened to all types of music and made it his own. And that's kind of where I was going with that as well.
And that's one of the reasons why I also wanted to have you on the show here too as well, as on the premiere one, is your taste for music. Not only is it absolutely phenomenal in so many different ranges, but it even falls into your taste for movies. Mm-hmm. And that's where I'm going to start to pick your brain on a little bit of this. Sure. Because I know that's somewhere where you'd like to go. But before we get into that avenue, I want to know, you've got a new book that's going to be coming out.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
A couple right now. The one that I'm almost done writing, I've got maybe two or three chapters left to finish for editing purposes. It's called Where the Day Sleeps, formerly entitled The Lighthouse Keeper, but yeah, I decided to switch that up a bit. Anyways, it's the story of a jazz musician as he's going through his life. It takes place in the early 2000s. He's reminiscing about his time in the late 60s in California on the jazz scene, mostly throughout Monterey and just up the west coast of the U.S. It's told at the same time as he's reading the diary or journals of his grandfather, who happened to be a baseball player during the 1920s. So those experiences of road life, from the baseball player or athletic aspect of life, with the road stories of a jazz musician kind of tied together, the loneliness that ties into that, relationships, different things like that put together. And that's kind of the crux of the story. And then even, you know, pulling together a full life on the road, taking all these different things, dealing with loss. It's kind of expansive, a lot of territory there.
So I know when you were writing this book, you and I were talking about it a fair amount, mm-hmm. and the traveling aspect of the musician to the ball player in the 20s to that whole environment.
Yep.
Can you you went on a train trip across the West Coast, specifically using train travel to mm-hmm. kind of get the vibe of the 1920s ball player of moving around. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on that as to how it connected to the traveling musician in the 2000s? Because they're not going to be using, obviously, the same modes of transportation, but
right.
the element is still there of the same. So how much of that train ride that you took allowed you to put yourself in the mindset of that traveling mm-hmm. musician, ball player, salesman, whoever is somebody who's traveling, of that character to do that? Like, what? How much did that train ride affect the writing of the book?
Actually, quite a bit. Most of it's going to be based on, one, you're in a specific kind of time and place where you're stuck. You've got maybe 5-minute intervals when you stop at stations. If you're a smoker, to jump out and have a smoke, which I'm not anymore, but I got to tell you, when you're stuck on a train, you kind of want to become one again. To jump out just for that 5 minutes. It's like, oh, I need to stretch my legs, quote
unquote. That's like when you're at work, right?
Yeah, of course, right? Where you just need to get off the train. The other parts of that, too, it comes down to the relationships that you make with different people and the conversations that you have. Because I don't know if anybody else has experienced it, but when you're in transit at any point in time, it could be in the city, wherever, longer trips, You have a lot of time on your hands, and there's things that are there for you to do. You can read for so long, you can listen to music for so long, but eventually you have to interact with somebody. This particular trip that I took, I was stuck on for about 48 hours, so 2 days on a train. People come and go, you end up making new friends, having conversations, and that was one of the main aspects of it that kicked in. There's different things as you're passing by on the outside the windows, the way the moon shines in through the trees, different landscapes. It really helps with creativity, and I found that I wrote a lot more based on that, which helped back that part of my life as well.
One of the things that I want to touch on with that, and I totally agree with you when you're especially transit nowadays in the Vancouver city, and one of the main reasons why, I don't want to say it's not a main reason, but if I had to pick transit over driving, I'd probably pick transit. Put on a pair of headphones, understand the world, understand the people, understand the look, or the way that it works. Now, you said that you started to have conversation with people. What were some of these conversations that you might have had?
There's actually a lot of really cool people I met. I mean, and this is the weird thing that I found, too. A lot of times you'll get this weird vibe where they say Americans are not very friendly. And I took my trip again down the coast from Vancouver to Los Angeles. And everybody that I met was American. They're traveling back home, whatever. They're all just phenomenal people, very friendly, very open, willing to discuss different things. And it was multiple generations. So older people, just having conversations about, it could be anything, the economy, the differences between Canadian versus American lifestyle, dollar value and stuff like that. Or I actually met a musician from the Seattle area as well, who was playing acoustic guitar on the train, which is pretty cool for a while until they made him stop doing it. But, you know, writing a book about a musician and then actually meeting a traveling musician who was kind of struggling and trying to get his career going, to me, that was pretty cool. Different people like that, photographers, a lot of people that are studying different things, you know, that especially in the arts where they're trying to get going, to me, that was pretty cool, talking to them about, you know, how do you get started, what do you look at, what inspires you. It was phenomenal.
Absolutely. It's obviously. How long did he actually get to play the guitar for? I'm just curious about that.
He played for roughly, I would say, probably half hour to 45 minutes.
Did he busk? Did he make some money at least?
Unfortunately, not. No, he was playing it in the station though too, and a lot of people were actually making complaints at that time. But he's pretty good.
And it's just hearing these stories. It's one of the reasons again why I wanted to have you on here. Just the mindset and the fact that you would go on a train ride. Mm-hmm. And do all those and go on that adventure even by yourself or with somebody just for that life experience is pretty cool.
It made sense for the character. I wanted to get into the character's head because it is written as a first-person narrative. So to me, it has to have some sort of truth coming from that person. So I have to live a bit of their life. Obviously, it is a fictional character. I can't go through and do everything that they did. It'd be cool if I could transport myself back to the late 60s and become a jazz musician.
Absolutely.
But with that, at least, these little kind of things that inform you of how your life is led and where you spend the majority of your time, especially if you're traveling around by train a lot, you spend a lot of time alone, and you have these kind of interactions, that's where a lot of your art comes from, and that's kind of where I wanted to get into the character.
And, you know, I really look forward to when this comes out, and you say about early 2015.
That's what I'm hoping for. Like I said, a few edits right now. It should come out sometime within the early spring, I'm hoping at the latest. Other than that, I do have a couple other projects I'm working on. They're about half written. But nothing... I have no time frame on when those come out.
On that trip, I know you did something that is near and dear to your heart as much as writing is. You went to... Was it two or three parks?
Just went to the one, yeah. I wanted to do two, but I can only do the one.
Oh, see, I thought you went to Angel Stadium as well, but okay, no, so it was just... Yeah. Okay, so, but on your trip as well, you know, you went to a baseball game.
Yeah.
And the picture you sent me was a jealousy-inducing picture of sitting along the third baseline?
I was actually out in... I took some pictures from around the stadium, okay. But I was sitting out in left center field close to the fence because I figured prime home run kind of spot for the guys that were playing everything, but yeah.
But also, you as growing up were a pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
Writing a book about baseball, traveling on the train, watching... You're getting... Or not entirely about baseball, the book is.
Yep.
But riding the train, going to L.A., going to Chavez Ravine,
yeah,
and watching... a throwback player in Clayton Kershaw, and who was the... Oh, sorry. Clayton Kershaw, and who were they playing that? I can't remember.
They're playing the Diamondbacks, so it was Kershaw versus Miley.
Okay, yeah. So a
couple of
for some reason in my mind, I thought you had the sweetness of a Kershaw Baumgartner to watch that game.
That would have been phenomenal,
would have been the best, but... As somebody who can watch a player and pinpoint that stuff and translate it onto paper, how much did going to the park in that environment also help with the player perspective of writing that book?
Well, I was going to say, and for some reason for me, one of the main things that stuck out of my head was watching Kershaw's warm-up. And usually when you see a pitcher warming up, if you're watching a game on TV, you'll see a guy kind of throwing in like a bullpen session, basically, right? He's down there throwing from normal, you know, 60-foot, 6-inch kind of thing. Watching Kershaw when he was warming up, he was actually in center field throwing to the left field line. So he's doing these monster kind of throws to warm up his arm, which to me was, I don't know, as a former pitcher, I would have burnt my arm out before the game even started. And watching him just do that, always hitting spots, it was.
Brilliant. Were they done in a pitching motion, or were they done as like I'm throwing from center field to second base kind of thing?
Full on kind of pitching motion, like you'd see in a bullpen session, where it's not like full, you know, off the rubber kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But he's taking like kind of a skip step into it. But at the same time, the way he's throwing it is like this guy's arm. It's easy to see why he's one of the most dominant pitchers in the game for sure right now. Now I'm probably gonna say in about 5 or 10 years. Being that he's a young guy, he won't be doing that anymore. But just watching that and the fact that the way that the game went, it's like, yeah, it was amazing.
A tendonitis builds real quick.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah,
absolutely.
But, yeah, it was, to me, seeing that, and again, Chavez Ravine going to, you know, watch a Dodgers game there, it was a kind of a dream come true, especially when you walk up and you get to hear Vin Scully's kind of voice as you approach the stadium. Pretty cool. It's a bit of a walk up the hill to get there, but yeah, it was definitely one of those experiences I'm glad I took. And to tie it in with the book, watching the players and the Dodgers were not having a good time at that point in time, so again, to me, seeing it that way, it's like the stuff that the player has to work through. It was early May, You know, they're struggling. They actually made the playoffs that year, which is cool to see them turn it around. But watching the way the players interacted in a downtime to try to bring the game back together, it really tied in a lot of stuff for me for the book.
Was Puig there yet?
Puig was not quite there yet.
Because I wanted to ask about a raw skill set. Yeah,
unfortunately,
like that.
I wish I didn't get to see him. But, I mean, I got to see guys like Camp and, you know, and Gonzalez and guys like that play. But, yeah.
So, since you only got to go to Chavez Arena, which lucky chance at least to at least go to one park to be a stadium that is an older one, because I know how much the history of baseball appeals to you as much as it does to me. What other parks were you planning on going to before other situations upon the trip got in the way, whether it be spending time with friends and people that you were wanting to see? Mm-hmm. What other parks were you planning to go to as well on this trip?
Well, there's a couple. I mean, it was a West Coast trip, right? So at first, like, the main goal was to go down to LA and check out things down there. So obviously Dodger Stadium at Chavez Ravine was on the list. I was planning to go to Anaheim to check out an Angels game, being an Angels fan myself. Which is kind of funny, because when I was at the Dodger game, I was wearing my Mike Trout jersey, and Matt Kemp kept on giving me dirty looks from center field. And I think he did notice it, and he was giving me kind of those, like, what are you doing at this game? Wrong park. But aside from that, yeah, like, Angel Stadium would have been nice. Of course, it's a bit of a trip to go to Anaheim there, and I had other plans, and I went to different places. A lot of cool cultural things to see, obviously, in L.A. When you go down there, I took a bit of a side trip to the La Brea Tar Pits, and then the Getty Center, which I would definitely recommend to anybody that's into art or artistry of any kind, you know, especially photography. Fantastic place there, and he was really quite, you know, the entrepreneur when it came to business, but he really did support the arts, and especially people in the visual arts. So great place for that. There is a museum up there as well. It is free of charge, which is the best part, and people get to hang out up there and do stuff.
For a Getty exhibit, that's pretty
neat. Oh, yeah, it was a fantastic place to go to, and a great view up there. But other than that, when I went back up toward Seattle to come back across the border, I was trying to get into a Mariners game too at that time, but the way that it worked out for me to catch my bus back up, it didn't pan out. They were playing the A's that night. I kind of hung out in the Mariner Alley behind the stadiums, got a hot dog, and caught a bit of the last four innings, which was just phenomenal that night. I think there was like 8 runs scored in the last four innings. I really wish I just said screw it on the bus and stayed in Seattle for the night and gone to the game. But yeah, other than that, like, I wanted to take a side trip to Colorado if I could have, to go to a Rockies game and things like that, but it just didn't work.
Did you have a chance to, if you could have, stopped in San Francisco along the way, gone to...
I thought
to,
about to, it.
AT&T Park?
The way that it was with the train stops, the one down the West Coast there, it stops in Oakland,
mm-hmm.
and I did stop there for a bit and kind of hung out.
And who wants to go to Alameda?
And that's the thing, right? Yeah, exactly. It's not really a great baseball stadium to go to. Giants game would have been phenomenal, but it's a bit of a sidetrack. It would have kind of added on an extra day, so I decided not to do that.
Fair enough.
Otherwise, yeah, I mean, that's something definitely for the future. The other thing I was thinking of too for this, because the baseball aspect of the book mostly takes place on the East Coast, because we're looking at 1920s, there's some pretty cool, and I would recommend this to anybody who wants to take a train ride, awesome train trips through Eastern United States with Amtrak, which are actually... The funny thing about the train ride too is I was kind of balancing out the fact that a lot of the stuff 20s, 60s versus nowadays... There's a lot of things that have changed in society that you can't do, i.e. again, smoking on the train. Even the bar car has kind of changed a bit for how things worked, right? Bar car kind of taken over by the observation deck. But I tried to work those in. The elements are still the same, the way that the seats are set up and the way people get on and off the train, where it stops and that. So,
and the possible interaction between the passengers has got to still be... relatively the same, depending on, like if you're only going from, you know, a hop, skip, and a jump from, like, say, Seattle to Portland on that train ride, you know, you're not going to need a cabin or anything like that. And you went cabin-less on your trip as well, which I know. So sleeping in rows to anything like that, so...
Well, sleeping in your seat is fun, especially when they're doing stops and somebody new gets on, and you fall asleep with one person next to you, and you wake up with somebody else. That's... That's a bit
oh,
of
oh, that's kind of creepy. I haven't personally experienced anything like that, but that I know would be creepy for sure.
Well, yeah. And you kind of pick up a conversation there. It's a bit of an awkward moment at first because, you know, you wake up and you maybe you had a bit of drool in your beard or something.
Did I fart my sleep?
It's like, you know it's me public. More intimately than I want you to, and I don't even know who you are or what you
You haven't
in,
even, but, you know, bought me dinner yet.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, right? Something else to write about perhaps for the future, but yeah.
And speaking about writing for the future too as well, you talked about other projects that might be on the go.
Yes.
What might you have? What do we have coming down the pipeline? And what could people look forward to seeing from yourself?
Sure. I mean, the ones that I've done before, so Between the Devil and Charlie Parker, a bit more of a kind of historical or time piece. It's set in the 50s. The new one again, set in 20s, 60s, and then up to 2000. And a bit more kind of set as, again, like I said, timepieces or historical, tied to that element. For myself now, the new ones are more, I guess you can say they're a bit more me in there. The main one would be, it's based on a writer's life, and he's a bit of a popular writer, so kind of unlike me in that sense, but popular writer that is deciding to stray from his audience and do something that he really wanted to do on the artistic side. That he's always wanted to do, and his agent is advising him against it. So he ends up creating kind of a scandal that will allow him to alienate himself from his fans and then kind of get new fans based on that. That one's actually called Everything in Moderation, with the exception of Ego, which I think Mike would probably really enjoy. Just to throw it out there. But again, it's a bit more me. It's more kind of tongue-in-cheek, a lot more comedy, a lot more sarcasm involved in that versus being set in a specific time and place where I kind of have to tone myself down to be more into that element, right?
Okay, so I'm going to ask a question that is a deeper answers. This is probably going to get into territory here that most people didn't expect a first episode to get into here, but You had a very interesting upbringing,
mm-hmm.
in what you've always told me, and you don't need to elaborate on it too much if you don't feel like it. But I know you enough that you probably will. It doesn't really matter here. So, how much your father
right.
was deaf and blind, right?
Not deaf, just blind. Yeah.
Okay, just blind. Sorry, yeah. For some reason I don't know why I always assumed he was for some reason deaf.
That's
and blind.
All good.
But blind. How much did I know his disability played a part in your upbringing, but how much did that play a part in possibly your creative style?
Yeah, a couple. The interesting thing too, just the one word to riff on a bit, I would say, and it's true. A lot of people look at it as disability. I would again, I kind of don't like that word. I classify it more as differently abled, for the fact that when I think of my dad, he had a lot of abilities that I think probably exceed most people that would have, say, full capacity, his vision, whatever, right? And a lot of talent, a lot of different things that he could do, crazy, wicked imagination, super smart, probably one of the smartest people I've ever met.
A blind DJ.
Oh, exactly, right? And that was part of the thing. Like, he used to DJ in, I think it was St. Thomas, Ontario, so just south of London where I grew up, where he did a ton of great work there. He was a huge baseball guy, so a lot of influence there as well.
Let's just differentiate here. DJ as disc jockey, not
not a computer
not
playing
as a rap DJ, no. But as a real original disc jockey, WKRP,
yeah, so
that
exactly,
kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Not the stuff
Johnny
that you
Fever,
see now.
Johnny Fever, 100% of that. So 70s,
Old Man Jack,
80s,
ooh.
Yeah. He was an actual like radio DJ, so he'd be, you know, online kind of doing the talking and stuff and then playing different songs and whatnot. So pretty cool in that sense. And again, like being blind, a bit of a people would think it would be a bit of a difficulty, but he just kind of set up his, you know, it's more setting things up in advance. These are the songs I want to play. And he'd have an idea in his head of where he wanted to go, have them in a certain order, pop it on, get it done. And to me, like watching him do that kind of stuff, even as a kid, with different things, especially at Christmas time, he'd always queue up different Christmas albums and find different songs and do that. It was amazing to watch just his ability to do that kind of stuff as one, you know, somebody that was a music fan, but two, as like an audio engineer, there was no, you know, the blindness was not in the way whatsoever for that.
Especially with the the whole aspect of the heightened senses. You know, you lose one sense, everything else heightens itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, picking apart music at that point to find the proper thing to play at that, especially as a DJ, like sitting there as somebody who could probably, you know, maybe not so much taking calls at that point of even people calling in. And it's the 70s, people probably aren't calling in as much and requesting songs as much as they used to, but to kind of keep the flow of the evening going, especially at that point in time when you were the DJ for the town.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it was, you know, as you said earlier, Wolfman Jack or somebody who became that thing. And you know, we may never know of DJs in the same sense that we did back then.
Well, it makes sense. Yeah, you were the heartbeat. You're the one that brought the energy to the night, right? You either made or broke the night at the time. And I think that's kind of where he was going with it. And he had a phenomenal ear for talent, and he would pick up different stuff musically that most people wouldn't hear. His mixes, you would think on the surface that if he told you two different kind of bands or the songs that they wouldn't work out. But for some reason, that mix or that flow that he created is one of those things that I took with me. And again, this is a bit of a dating myself maybe on my age, but through the 80s and 90s making mixtapes, especially on the old TDK tapes.
We've all been there. I have a few still sitting in the closet.
But it's a lost talent, right? It's a forgotten art to create this wicked flow for 45 minutes to flip the side and be able to pick it up and keep it going from there and have it suddenly, you know, revolve around. It's people don't do that anymore. It's
absolutely. Yeah. It's all about downloading the music and going for what's just there, right?
Too much cut and paste, right?
Well, as we were talking about earlier, the whole aspect of the album mm-hmm. has been left by the wayside, you know? And luckily, you know, I've found myself a few bands out there that still have the aspect of the album in place, bands like Titus Andronicus or Diarrhea Planet. Yes, the name of the band is Diarrhea Planet. They are amazing, but these bands out there, like there are a few out there that still bring the aspect of the old vinyl record. I'm going to put this on side A, side B.
Mm-hmm.
And when that's out there, it creates a different thing. To touch back on the book, the creation of a soundtrack for the book, the creation of the way that an album is supposed to be built. Just as the chapters of the book apply to different songs, to different things, the chapters of an album are the songs, and they tell a story, and it's something that I wish would be a stronger representation in the music world today. It's not, mm-hmm. unfortunately, but there are bands that still do it, and I think that sooner or later, as we were talking earlier, the whole analog aspect of people wanting vinyl again, you know, it's the fastest growing purchase, people buying of music, like it's the fastest form of music growing in sales out there right now.
For me, it just makes sense too. If you look at it, the sound quality alone versus digital music and the analog, it's why would you take an 80% drop in sound quality as a music lover or a fan of music for like a digital recording when you can get this analog, which again, it's not as close as you get to a live performance, which is obviously the way to go. But why would you take an 80% drop in sound quality to buy a CD or a digitalized version of it when you can just get it the way that it was intended to be listened to and actually feel the emotion from the artist and the heart being put into it? And it's the same kind of thing. I always say this with paper books versus ebooks. Don't want to really riff on technology too much because it's beautiful to have that to take with you. But you lose this tactile sense, which I think happens a lot in digital media versus actual media.
There's definitely a different attachment to reading a physical book, whether it be in paperback or hardback or hardcover, to reading something in an ebook mentality. Even if it gives you that textured look on the ebook, there's something tangible about holding a book in your hand and a sense of accomplishment of flipping through all the pages. More so than swiping your finger from left to right to get through the book.
Not only that, in a digital way, I feel like everybody kind of forgets what's there. It's on your computer, there's endless content, your e-readers or whatever it might be, but when you own something like a book or a DVD or a CD, it's something that you get to hold and cherish forever. It's not something that could be wiped away with a delete or a virus or I don't use it anymore. It's something that you can always have.
Well, and it creates a physical memory, right? You walk by your bookshelf. Maybe you don't consciously notice that you're looking at it, but you see it, and it gets in your mind. And maybe the next day you're like, you know what? I want to watch that movie. Or I wouldn't mind picking up that book and reading it again. Or like a CD or whatever, like an LP. And the other thing for me with music is I love liner notes. I love pulling out the booklet and reading through and be like, oh, here are the lyrics. Here are the pictures of the time when the band recorded it. And you get a more intimate connection with the with
that's
the
a lost art from the album era, we'll just call it that for the time being. The liner notes was, you know, always a major thing. Like, I remember picking up, you know, going through my dad's old records back in the day and picking it up and opening it. And once you opened that record, dependent if it was just a front cover or a back cover, if they were differentiating, or if it was, you're supposed to open it up and view this entire thing. Like, that Queen album. Mm-hmm. I always remember that one with the Mechanical Man, like with We Will Rock You, and I can't remember the name of the album right now off the top of my head, but with We Will Rock You and We Are the Champions is on it, and he's reaching over and like he's got people stuck on his fingers, yeah. And they're scooping them up as if it's like kind of like a War of the Worlds kind of being scooping down. It you open that record and it gave you the full aspect of the cover. It was there, the cover had this one thing, but then once you opened it, it gave you this whole other idea upon it. And that is missing, you know? The fact that artists used to actually make album covers compared to, you know, a photo of a band now or just a quick little drawing. But the fact that people went out of their way to actually create a mosaic, whether it, you know, physical graffiti with the spinning of the dial or was it physical graffiti? No, Zeppelin 3. Zeppelin 3 was the spinning of the dial.
That's the one, yeah.
And physical graffiti with the picture of the building with the different types of people in each window.
I always think of the Stones album with the zipper on the cover.
The sticky fingers.
I think of Meatloaf too with when he's on the bike.
You open that up and he's like jumping the gorge kind of thing. And it had things.
Even the Black album.
They had this different feel to them. The Black album, because it was solid black. And if you tilted the CD cover in the light, you could see the was it a snake in the background?
That's right.
But if you had the
snake
full
as an earring, by the way, back in the day, we'll let that.
Did you?
But if you had the full album, you saw that. I had the Black album for 2.5 years before I realized there was a snake on the cover.
Yeah,
and it's a missing thing now.
It's the little things that really matter.
Well, and you lose the context, right? When you put things together, an album is meant to be listened to in a specific order. There's a reason why the songs are put in that order. If you listen to them now, it's all sampling. And tying back to what you mentioned about movies, it always reminds me of that, I don't know if you guys remember in Demolition Man when they're driving around and Stallone's just kind of woken up to the future and Sandra Bullock's driving around the car and they put on the radio and all you hear are little jingles. That's the new music of the day, is like commercials. It always reminds me of that nowadays where everything's a sample. It's not anything tangible. It's just like a little 30-second snippet of a sample.
It's just like the commercial hip-hop game, which is, you know, dropping the name brand of something within the song.
And as it's gone on with the evolution, it's always been something different as a pinpoint for all those songs. Now, every year, there is a thing that goes on YouTube, and it started, I believe, in 2006. I'm sure I'll get corrected on that, of a group. They would call it United States of Pop, and they would do a remix of all the songs throughout the year. Now, when we're talking about sampling and cookie cutters, every year, with all the lyrics and everything mixed together, all to one instrumental, every song every year has the exact same sound to it. Every year for the longest time that I can remember. Not like it used to be, where everybody was very unique in their own ways. Like when... actually, one thing I do want to ask, now that we're talking about this, is, and I'm very curious to know this, first album, record album, that you ever listened to. And Mike, I'll start off with you.
Did I ever listen to or ever owned?
No, we'll go to listen to. Okay. Maybe you got it from a cousin, dad.
That's going
to
make things a little bit difficult, but...
Well, that one thing that
stood out for me was... I remember in 1989. Yep, dating myself, but whatever. 1989. My family's house was broken into, and you know, the my dad had this bar built into our like family room kind of thing, and with the stereo hooked up and speakers throughout the house, and he had, you know, his he had music stolen, so we got that, you know, A&B Sound gift card back in the day.
A&B Sound,
even dating myself even more. Wow. Here.
We only had two locations where we grew up,
but he went out and he bought these box sets of his favorite musicians and stuff like that. So we had like a Rolling Stones one, AC/DC, whatever, but Led Zeppelin. Ooh, and nice. And in that box set, it was very similar. It was a lot of songs from, you know, disc one was a lot of songs from like Zeppelin one, partially Zeppelin two, but specifically on that set, it was disc two for me, man. Like, I listened to that a lot. Like, What Is and What Should Never Be is a song that means more to me than I think that anybody else. When I ask you, you know, give me a Zeppelin song, you might tell me, you know, yeah. We'll get rid of the No Stairway Allowed here, obligatory here. But, absolutely. You know, you might be throwing out some Ramble On, some Dazed and Confused. Well,
honestly, nobody's fault
some,
but mine.
Some rock and roll. And see, that's a little bit more obscure of it. But I say What Is and What Should Never Be, and people look at me and they're like, I don't even know that Led Zeppelin song. And that's what I listened to as a kid. And the rule in my house was, you can't have your own music until you learn to appreciate what became before you. So for me, it was a box set of called Hitsville USA, which was four discs of Motown and a Led Zeppelin four-disc box set that I listened to on loop for about the time that I was 1989. So I was four, but once we got these, I was 5 years old until I was 10 years old when I got my first music of my own. That's what I listen to, whether it be record or CD.
Now, since I have you on that subject, and just real quick, first album owned.
I was 10 years old. It would have been 2 days ago, since we were recording this on Friday, November 28th. It would have been November 26th. Jesus Christ. 20 years ago, as of 2 days ago. I got Green Day Dookie.
Oh, wow.
On
CD.
Okay, CD.
This is 1994 we're talking about here, folks. Yep. And and the second album that I opened on that birthday was Counting Crows, August and Everything Out.
Geez.
Oh,
wow.
So the complete opposite sides of the spectrum, to give you an idea of what I was doing, what I was listening to at the time. But like,
what artistry at its finest at that
but,
point.
But, you know, having an older sibling also affected that as well, you know, like, but around the time that I got that album, that Green Day album, because it was, you know, semi-punk rock, air quotes here, but my sister, being a couple years older than me, was already listening to that kind of stuff, and so I had, at the same time, and Out Come the Wolves in 1996, say?
95, yeah.
95, yeah. I had, you know,
NoFX, Punk and Drublic.
Punk and Drublic, 1994. Yeah. You know, like, I had those things already there as well before I got this. So I had this, you know, punk rock, for lack of a better term, because I don't really like to classify them as punk rock, considering how, you know, popular opinion says punk rock died in 1978.
It's East Bay music kind of thing, right?
I mean, East LA, that whole vibe, like that thing, and that's what I got in 1994. That's what I started with of my own music.
That's very funny that you say that. I'm going to come back to that. Matt, first album.
We're getting into embarrassing territory now for
no,
me?
No, hey, no. It's not about dating.
This would have been like, 1982?
That's the best part about this show is that we all range in age, and the fact that we have such an eclectic taste and fall onto the same pages no matter how far we go.
True.
What would be the first album owned, or sorry, the first record that you've ever listened to, because I know we all started when there was records.
Yeah.
And then we'll get you to carry on from there.
Sure. So again, you know, I've already mentioned a bit about my dad being a DJ, so music was always a huge part of the life for me. So with him and my mom as well, as a crazy music fan, there was quite a bit going on with that, where it's to me, the one that stuck out the most, and this comes from my mom, is listening to The Who, The Who's Next. So you got Barbara O'Reilly, Bargain, you know, Won't Get Fooled Again, all that kind of stuff.
It's funny that you say Barbara O'Reilly. What do most people consider that song to be called, which is absolutely wrong?
Yeah,
no, that's fine. We'll come back to that one. Go ahead.
I was gonna say I'm always focusing on, but that was the one that to me, like, I remember going to you know, as a young kid, we used to go to the fair every year in the city that I grew up in, and they always played like awesome 70s kind of rock music on every ride that you went on. There was always a DJ.
There's always Dire Straits in my car.
Oh, the old fairground, though. This is what I'm saying for that. It was always like you go on a ride. I remember this one called, it was called the Himalaya. It's one of the big experiences for me that went, it was basically like almost a kiddie ride where it was kind of an up and down. It went around one way and then it reversed. But the fact that there was a live DJ there playing wicked rock tunes.
Flip
the thing down,
flip it and reverse it.
It made it worthwhile. Exactly. Right? Exactly.
Before you
it
carry on.
It was not Missy Elliott, though. It was close.
Before you carry on, just for those who heard the Bubba O'Reilly and what went on, most people get this wrong so many times. It is not called Teenage Wasteland. It is called Bubba O'Reilly, okay?
Yeah, no,
sorry,
yeah.
Carry on. I just wanted to point that out because most people call it Teenage Wasteland, and I'm like, that is not the name of the song. Please carry on.
But yeah, I mean, that kind of stuff. So that was really the album for me was Who's Next growing up. And the fairground tie-in, as I remember once being there with my mom, and she actually won a Who mirror that said the Who in the top corner at one of the kind of games and that. And it was like a huge standout. It was like, you know, that's the music I listened to. She won that thing. It's so cool. But, you know, that's obviously a kid's thoughts in the big world. But unfortunately, the first album that I owned is a bit more embarrassing, which really kind of sucks because my mom and dad had wicked music all the time. And then, you know, growing up, you get into teenagers. For myself, I was kind of branching out. And the first CD that I got, because my parents already had all this other music that I needed to kind of get my own music.
But your first album would have been a CD.
It no. was my first,
fuck off.
Yeah, I didn't, well, because my parents had so much awesome stuff
that's true.
Already on.
That's
LP
true. If he already had everything, then, I mean, what's the point
still,
of branching out?
Well, no, it would have been like what 1980?
No, 1990. But, I was born in the '70s, right?
But, yeah, so. But you got to think about it though. It's not like he made his cassette tape mixtapes. We all know
exactly.
That.
Well,
but
so
an actual
we did
album
that too.
Owned.
We used to fucking hit record and play on the radio.
And this is the problem. Is what the transition, and I'll go historical, and I know this is a fact. I know CDs came out in 1983.
That's
most
correct.
People did not own
no, Laserdisc, and then it went to that.
Because I remember 88 being them. Like, well, 88, 89 was where they became, like, popular.
Absolutely, yeah. Is when
where things
affordable.
Were released upon them.
Back in 1983 is when the first CD was released. I remember seeing that on, like, a CD that I owned
okay.
for some reason. But anyways, but that's the case for those, fine. I was still a cassette tape guy. So if you talk, like, I was born in the late 70s when I was in the 90s.
So,
like 13,
so did
14.
You go, so you went with more with the single kind of vibe, right?
Well,
because of the cassettes?
I bought a lot of cassette singles? Tape. So I owned, as an example, if you said cassette tape, I did own, like, Nevermind by Nirvana. Stuff
okay,
like that
yeah,
on cassette
yeah, that's
tape.
What we mean
okay.
here.
However,
yeah.
first CD, if you went that way, or album in that sense.
Okay, what was the first CD?
Unfortunately, it was, like, an Amy Grant CD. I'm going to throw it there. I think it was,
you know
I think
what?
I think it was Amy Grant's Heart in Motion.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Women's
okay.
Mix 5.
Let's redeem yourself now. What was that cassette then?
Yeah,
that
that's
you got?
That's where we want to. Yeah.
What was that first? Whether it be which is vinyl, CD, cassette, 8-track, sure. Because that was in that crossover time for
so,
you.
Yeah, first
what would be that?
Would have been Two Live Crew.
Ooh.
Back in the day. So I did have a bit of a rap thing.
Absolutely.
When I was you know, going toward 10, 11.
Hey, man, like my 12th birthday? So, yeah, 12th birthday, I got All Eyes on Me and West Side Connection, you know, like, so.
Exactly, right? So Naughty by Nature, all that stuff was out at that time.
Absolutely.
Canadian reference for you. I had a lot of Maestro Fresh West back then as well.
Come on. Underrated musician.
Very underrated.
For sure.
And even so nowadays, if you look him up, a lot of people do credit him for, you know, being an inspiration.
Especially
him,
Canadian
so.
Ones. You got Shad, you got...
especially Shad.
The other dude. Not Kendrick Lamar. Why did I say that?
Who are you going to...
He just recently, he was up for Polaris a couple years ago. He's from Edmonton. Oh. I can't remember this fucking name right now.
For some reason, I thought it classified, but the ones you said Edmonton. But I did get a...
But definitely an influential person towards classified as well. Mm-hmm. But why? I'm going to look this up.
But I mean, even back then, again, dating myself on that, there's a lot of kid and play kind of influence as well from their TV shows and their movies and stuff, watching like the house party movies and stuff like that. But when you get into albums, and the main influence for me, again, unfortunately... at that time when I got into CDs, the Amy Grant thing sticks there. But there was a lot of like Seattle
Cadence Weapon.
There's a lot of like punk scene for sure, or grunge scene for me as well at that time, because music was taking a huge shift from hair bands into the good stuff. So Dark Ages into the more artistic aspects.
London, right? London, Ontario.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I know for me, growing up, you know, in the suburbs of the Fraser Valley of Vancouver, you know, I had these coffee jam shows, as they called them. You know, Gob used to play there all the time. You know, they were you know, acquaintances of my sister and things like that. But, you know, because of the age groups. But, you know, I saw bands like Nickelback there before, you know, they put anything of significance out.
I feel your pain.
No, but before they put anything of significance out, like before, you know, before Leader of Men, before their stuff that made them popular, mm-hmm. you know, I saw these bands in a different environment. Now, what was the music scene like in the, you know...
Southern Ontario, kind of?
Mid the late 80s, London, Ontario... Local music scene, like, you know, when you were in that grade 11, grade 12 range to university time, because you went to where for university again? Sorry.
Well, I actually came out this way, out west for university.
You didn't go out there first.
No, I was thinking about going to university for Western out there, but I ended up moving out west here and go to UBC okay. instead.
So then that time frame of, you know, grade 11, grade 12, mm-hmm. you know, you have 13?
Well, OAC in Ontario, okay. right, which is kind of...
Did you have that at the time?
No, it was optioned in for your grade 12 that you didn't have to take it, but yeah.
But what was London, Ontario like?
Cool
that time frame, like, what was the stuff like in UGrad and what, 90?
You're looking at early 90s to mid-90s up to 95 kind of thing. There's some really cool music. A couple that made it big, I don't know if you guys remember a band called Salmon Blaster from London, Ontario. Couple of good songs out of them. Mostly college music kind of scene. So bands called, one we were talking about earlier, called Adam West, based on, you know, 60s Batman series Adam West star. Pretty good. Another band called Boatman from London, Ontario, that I actually was into quite a bit. Pretty decent musician, now, locally trained as well. But
Now, at that same time in the Northwest United States was, you know, bands like Dave Matthews Band and things like that
right.
were becoming popular. Was there anything like that that kind of like, you know, because I always find it interesting that like organically the same kind of thing that becomes like, you know, a popular thing in one place is also whether... maybe not as strong of it, but it's a developing scene somewhere else. Was there something, because this is the early 90s and stuff like that, you know, the grunge was Pacific Northwest and the West Coast, more of that kind of vibe. The East Coast had an entirely different thing. Was it more of like that jam band Dave Matthews style thing, or was it more of like a, you know, fist to the air, like, rock our balls off kind of thing?
Well, I think a lot of the sound at that time, I mean, obviously you look at bands from Kingston like that, like Tragically Hip came out around that time, late 80s, early 90s.
Absolutely.
But, that's why I was kind of wondering.
A lot of the Southern Ontario bands at that time really, I think, were kind of mimicking more of the East Coast, like the Massachusetts kind of sound of like Pixies, Throwing Muses, bands like that, or the Chicago sound of the rising bands like Smashing Pumpkins, or... You've got bands like Lemonheads, or even in the kind of faux punk or punk scene of like Screeching Weasel and bands like that. There's a lot of that kind of amalgamation mix with a bit of the West Coast kind of grunge influence coming in as well. Which, unfortunately, when bands are looking at all these great kind of things happening, I think that's kind of how grunge was born anyways, where it's like, we love all these different types of music. Let's find one that kind of brings them all together.
Considering how the most... you know, obscure person from that you would not classify as grunge rock into that category is considered the grandfather of grunge, being, you know, Neil Young.
Right.
in that aspect. And then, you know, a forgotten album like Mirrorball, where he kind of dove headfirst into that grunge vibe. It's just always interesting to me in that time frame, because there was so much stuff going on in different pockets where, you know, we have so much of a different context upon that now, as we can actually watch these pockets develop organically because of the internet, because of that aspect.
Absolutely.
And I never got the opportunity to watch that aspect of things. And that time period is just so intriguing, because when you really look at, like, what was coming out, like you said, like the Lemonheads out of the Midwest, and you've got, you know, the Pixies coming out of the Northeast, and you've got Nirvana and Pearl Jam and stuff coming out of the Northwest, and you've got what was, like, an LA band at the time, Chili Peppers and things like that coming out of LA, and then, you know, down south, like the Florida aspects of things, like everything had.
What do you got, Tom Petty back there?
Tom Petty being more popular back there, but there was. Each place had its own kind of vibe, and I've never really, you know, the hip is the thing that everybody accumulates as the Canadian aspect of it during that time frame. But there's more going on. It's just like, you know, DOA wasn't huge, but look at how influential they were on bands from... Fuck, DOA would influence bands from Australia, you know, and things like that. And really, they're an independent band from Vancouver that is not given their due, but given their due by the musicians, but not given their due by the people.
True, I can see that. I mean, and speaking of forgotten music, I mean, in a lot of times in Canada, people forget about it. But even at that time, in Ontario especially... There's a lot of bands coming out, like Blue Rodeo, Cowboy Junkies, kind of stuff like that, that are around that area that people forget about. And country music, for some reason, in Canada, I'm not a huge country fan, but it's
forgotten. I am now.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, more so now than I'm older. Yeah.
As I showed
it's an acquired taste, of course.
As I showed you guys some of that new style of it now, like, you know.
But it was always there, though, right?
Nashville's a machine.
No, and that's how it's come from one end to another, and how it's changed and evolved, and now that the fact that we've come full circle, and we're back to the way it kind of was.
Well, I mean, I think a person like Shania Twain from Timmins, a bit southern, like Northern Ontario, brought it all together.
Yeah, we could have an entire hour-long discussion here about country music if we really wanted to. In the fact that, you know, modern country is something entirely different than what country music used to be. Country music used to be the Nashville machine, and it still is, but not as much. Now it's, let's just churn out hits. Before it was, let's create these songwriters who will churn us out hits. But then these songwriters became the most popular things out there, and that doesn't happen anymore.
The art of music has, on certain levels, has died. And that's why somebody like myself likes to branch out to YouTube and other places to see what those people are doing, those songwriters and those people coming up with those very rare sounds, to be able to get that organic, as we've been saying, feeling of it all. Now, I know that we all range in age, and the fact that we were talking about our first albums and our first CDs and stuff like that, and me being the youngest one here, and it's very funny that the first album that personally I ever listened to, and based on my parents being big rock fans and going by the same... You know, you can't appreciate what's new until you listen to what's old. And I still distinctly remember coming up to my parents and going, Mom, Dad, do you have a Bee Gees album? And getting the weirdest fucking look I've ever had. But the first, I just wanted to hear one song. That was it. And it was Staying Alive. But
I remember finding that album in my dad's record collection, the Saturday Night Fever album. I have it sitting at my parents' place right now in my milk crate.
First album ever listened to was Led Zeppelin 2. And the fact that we all pointed out very rare songs of Led Zeppelin, mine would be Thank You.
Excellent choice.
Phenomenal. I listened to that thing on repeat. The fact that I was given a stereo with a record player and a speaker with the wires separate, and I had to figure that out, the minute I did, it was never turned off from that point forward. Now, the fact that we go to the first album owned is a big influence from my older brothers, because I am the youngest of my family.
I was wanting to ask that. I was going to be like, how much of an influence did your brothers have?
It can't be as embarrassing
as
my own on this one.
No, but I will.
But it depends on what his brothers were into, because his brothers are
My older brother, and I'm sure I'll catch shit for this. He's either 30, 31, or 32, one of the two.
Okay, so he's my age.
Yeah. And my middle brother is going to be, we're only a year apart. So okay. Give or take, but technically two. My middle brother wasn't much of an influence on music when it comes to certain sounds. My parents definitely rock. I'm the biggest Tragically Hip fan today because of my mom and, you know, cleaning the house with Tom Cochran playing on in the background. That's right. Life's a Highway.
I should give you my hip club card.
Man, Mad World, man. That's a great album.
I would love that. But the first album owned, and it was only because my brother had talked about it so passionately, and it was my birthday, and I went to my aunt. You know what? I wanted Green Day's Dookie. And sure enough, she bought that for me. Now, my brother put up a big fit for that. Now, this is where it all changes, because technically that is not my first album. Technically it is, but it was taken away from me within an hour.
Oh.
Given to my brother. My older brother is, and still to this
was
day.
Was it taken away from you because of Longview?
No, it was taken away from me because he wouldn't shut the fuck up.
Nice.
It was taken away from me because it was something that he wanted, and I didn't have a crutch to stand on. I had no 2 feet. I just stole his idea. Literally. All these years later, yes, I've said it. The album that was replaced, and I'm so thankful that this happened, was Aerosmith's Big Ones.
Ooh.
And that album. Wow. Absolutely. And that album, from Ragdoll to and I still call it Living in the Fridge, just because. But, I mean, Dude Looks Like a Lady. All those songs, I mean, from front to back, that was, I listened to it on repeat constantly. Now, when it comes to the first CD owned, it is D12.
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 It's not so bad.
That's such a huge gap, though. That's like, give or take, 1994 to 1999, D12?
But when it's ready available, you don't need to go buy for yourself.
But that's 5 years.
But you see, one of the things you got to know is, like...
Did you just burn your brother's CDs?
No,
and stuff like that?
I was so into cassette tapes and recording off the radio. There was a song for the long... Like, I love to make a cassette tape that was like a radio show.
Okay.
So I would play the song, cut it in between, because my cassette player had a microphone, external one, yeah. So we could talk.
I had a similar one.
Right? Cut in, be like Rick Dees in the Weekly Top 40s, and kind of go into that. For those who don't know who that is, the old disc jockey that used to... Yeah. Ryan Seacrest myself. Now does it, but...
Does he seriously?
Yes, he's the one that does the Weekly Top 40, technically.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, he does too, yeah.
Yeah. Did he
take over Casey Kasem or Rick Dees?
I think it's going to be Casey. Okay. Because Rick Dees, I believe, stopped in like 1998 or something like that. But I loved for the longest time making my own cassette tapes and creating my own playlist that way. And then it came down to a point where I begged my mom. I said, you know, we're going to Surrey Central, the mall at that time in Vancouver, British Columbia, or Surrey, whatever you want to call it. And I said, I really wanted a CD. And she said, pick whatever you want. And the fact that I got the D12 and I listened to Purple Pills constantly, that would have been, that's my first CD. And I, like you said, yes, such a big gap, but it's because of those cassettes. D12, if we know what D12 come out in, 1999,
it's got to be at least 99, 2000.
I started high school in 2000, and I grad in 2005, so that would have been grade 7.
That sounds about right for me, 2000.
Yeah, because I would have been in grade 4 when I first heard the Slim Shady LP. Stuff like that.
Makes
so,
sense, yeah. That sounds
and
right.
It's just, it's, and it's still to this day.
2001.
2000, okay, so 2001, Purple Pills. Well, so then it was the beginning of high school then. But I always have my brothers. Like, I wouldn't know Usher if it wasn't for my older brother. I wouldn't know Bone Thugs and Harmony. I wouldn't know Cypress Hill if it wasn't for my brother. I wouldn't know some of the great, great hip hop that we've had over the years if it wasn't for him. Now, my middle brother, like I said, didn't really influence too much when it came to music, except for Kid Rock. And then again, you know, it's still to this day, I'm a big fan of Kid Rock.
This is diversity alone. That's something to look at if you're a metal fan or if you're a rap fan or if you like country music. The fact that he has so many influences himself and he incorporates that into his shows, that makes him worth seeing for sure, right?
Absolutely. So unfortunately, guys, we're running out of time here on the first episode. And Matt, I just want to thank you so much for being the first guest that we've had here on Everybody Talks. I know that we really wanted to have a name for it. And this is something that's been in the works for a long time. And there will be a lot of people that we will be reaching out to when it comes to the show. Matt, give us another rundown just about yourself and where people can pick up your books and look forward to hearing from you.
Sure. So, I mean, right now the books are kind of online only. So you're looking at anywhere on there, Amazon, Chapters, Barnes & Noble. You can check it out. That's not a problem. So Between the Devil and Charlie Parker right now, in the new future, you're looking at, if I can get it out in the next year, Everything in Moderation with the Exception of Ego. And then the other one is called Where the Day Sleeps. That should be coming out pretty soon. As far as everything else, my Twitter account would probably be the easiest place to access me. So it would be... Matt Demo at Matthias Demo. And with that one, I do right now currently have, based on our topics we're talking about, CDs that influenced me in the 90s. Best complete albums for me, there's 26. I don't know why I chose 26. It's kind of a random number, but hey, there it is. The 26 albums that influenced me the most as a teenager. And right now I'm going through those. I've got three posted already on there, but for the next 23 days, I'll put the next 23 up there.
And as well. And just one last thing, just please spell out the Twitter account for us.
Sure. So it's MATTHIASDEMO is the Twitter account for that.
And for a lot of people, too, as well. Obviously, you can go to reaperproductions.ca. We will have the episode on there, too, as well, along with youtube.com/reaperproduction604. There will be a link there, too, as well, that will direct you right to Matt. So if you want to get his books or whatever it is, there will be information there for that, too, as well. Really appreciate you having coming on the show.
No, it's awesome. I'm glad to be here. Thanks a lot.
And I know that we'll definitely have you in the future. Everybody who is wanting to subscribe, we will be on iTunes coming up soon. We're working that out. But for now, subscribe to us on reaperproductions.ca. Go there, tell your friends, share it, whatever you need to do. We're going to be having our Twitter be coming up soon. The name was just decided just a couple of days ago. We're fresh. We're making it happen. We're running on the roll. We're flying at the seat of our pants. We do what we do. Mike, anything you want to add on before we sign off?
Nah, I just not much. Just if anybody's you know, looking for a good thing to listen to as an ending point, just a fantastic song to go out to. It kind of ties into the point of tonight about music and writing and everything like that. I want you all to go out and listen to the song by Titus Andronicus from an album called The Monitor by the name of Battle of Hampton Roads. It is 14 minutes long. Just trust me. Press play. Sit back. Relax.
And as you can already hear it in the background. Ladies and gentlemen, tune in next time as we roll the dice here on Everybody Talks.
We'll wash up on the shore and the mighty of earth will have no other recourse but to shiver and shake and make shit in their shorts, because we have been told that if you've been ashore, there's a way to live the values your forefathers gave you. Prepare to be told that shit's gay, dude. I guess that what they say is true. That there is no race more human, no one throws it away like they do. Nothing ties to love. Again. conservation syndrome. To the dregs, and now I'm heading west on 84 again, and I'm as much of an asshole as I've ever been, and there is still nothing about myself I respect. Still haven't done anything I did not lay to regret. A hand and a napkin when I'm looking for sex, and that's no one to talk to when feeling depressed. And so now when I drink, I'm going to drink to excess, and when I smoke, I will smoke keeping holes in my chest, and when I scream, I will scream until I'm gasping for breath, and when I get sick, I will stay sick for the rest of my days, peddling hate at the back of the shed, the express, each one a fart in the face of your idea of success, and if this be the will, then fucking pass me the cup, and I'm sorry, Dad, no, I'm not making this up. But my